and the coach set off on the short journey from the inn to the bridge. It was, one witness remembered, quite a sight. The high-mounted steeds, mantling their proud crescent necks, as if conscious of the triumphant achievement. As the coach reached the bridge, many more passengers tried to scramble aboard, wanting to be among the first to cross. The weather was wild. Amid glare of lamps, a heavy gale of wind blowing by this time, Provis recalled later, the passengers were joined by as many more as could be crammed in or find a place to hang by. Then, with the overloaded coach creaking, the iron gates that guarded the crossing were swung open for the first time. A crack of the whip put the horses in motion, and we were quickly conveyed to the opposite end, amidst the cheers of the men around us and the shrill whistling of the gale. And so, without more fanfare than this, on a horrible night, at 1:35 a.m. on the 30th of January, 1826, the Menai Bridge opened. It was the finest moment of Thomas Telford's career. At 68, he had built the most daring structure of his life, the first great suspension bridge of the modern age. Its central deck, almost 580 feet long, slung 100 feet above the tidal channel from 16 thick chains. The bridge was this stupendous effort of human genius, one popular guide of the time declared. The spectator cannot but be rapt in mute astonishment and adore the attributes of the great creator who endues the mind of man with gradual capacity for the construction and achievement of such labours. A local doctor in the crowd, as the bridge opened, bubbled with excitement. The national and splendid specimen of British architecture will be a lasting monument to the discernment of the present government for having calculated into requisition the transcendent talents of Mr. Telford, who has thus, by a positive proof of superior scientific knowledge and taste, signalised himself in this line, the first architect of his age. The Menai Bridge, he concluded, will rank in future ages as the eighth wonder of the world. Telford's response to all this was telling. A different man would have sought public glory. A different man would surely have insisted on crossing first that night, rather than letting his friends and juniors make the trip before him. A different man would have made a pompous speech, or wanted to name the bridge after himself, or perhaps tried to call it after King George IV in the hope it would bring him rewards, just as a different man would have sought honours or riches throughout his life. Telford wasn't like that, ever. If the design of his bridge exposes one side of his character, relentless, daring, ingenious, then the manner of its opening exposes another. Private, perhaps lonely, always travelling. And so the morning that followed that first windswept crossing was dominated by the bridge, and not by its designer. The political grandees who had backed the project made sure they were seen, of course. The first private carriage to cross, drawn by four beautiful greys, belonged to one of the parliamentary commissioners, and the second was Mr. Telford's. Soon after, the celebrated Oxonian stagecoach followed, heading for London and reputed to be the fastest in Britain. Then came a scrum of numerous gentlemen's carriages, landaus, gigs, cars, pony sociables, etc., etc., upwards of 130 in number, and horsemen innumerable. The royal standard flew from the great stone towers, cannons fired, and competing bands played on either shore. Joy, admiration, and astonishment seemed depicted in every countenance on beholding the proportion, symmetry, and grandeur apparent to the most common observer in every part of this unrivalled structure. A party began. At one time, the bridge was so crowded that it was difficult to move along, Provis wrote in a letter the next day. Most of the carriages of the neighbouring gentry, stagecoaches, postchaises, gigs and horses, passed repeatedly over and kept up a continuous procession for several hours.